Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Wrapping up National Apprenticeship Week and a message from the painters and allied trades. More on the John Deere settlement. And today on the show, the latest from the American Legion and the Alliance for Retired Americans. Welcome to the Friday, November 19th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on six platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Pandora, Spotify, and the platform known as Stitcher. Mr. Jeffrey Stoffer, who heads the Media and Communications Division of the American Legion, will be our first guest today. Legion.org for the complete updates. Jeff pretty much handles the magazine, and if you are a member of the Legion, you should be getting that shortly. I'm talking about the December edition. And on the cover, we're going to spend some time on this one. It's all about our public health system. Title of the article, Our Patchwork Public Health System. And this is a very, very comprehensive article, and it talks about how we got from years ago to today. And COVID-19 kind of exposed a lot of the problems in our healthcare system. I want to read a quote from the magazine here. It's like having a fish tank. You can spend as much money as you want on exotic fish, but if you don't keep the tank clean and change the water, they're not going to last long. We spend about 97 cents of our dollar on the fish and 3 cents on the water. Well, eventually, that's a recipe for disaster. Public health in the United States has always been a patchwork. In fact, the first health departments were started at the municipal level in response to local disease outbreaks. We're going back well over a century here. So we're going to get into that and what needs to be done. And we're also going to talk about the vaccine. There's a brief history about vaccine resistance. So what's happening in America right now is no surprise. None at all. The other article we're going to get into, the attack on Pearl Harbor 80 years ago. That's right. The anniversary coming up, December 7th, 1941. And we're going to hear a firsthand account from an American Legion vice commander who was in Honolulu on that fateful day. And Jeff found it in the archives of the American Legion. We'll talk about that. And lastly, the rise in national veterans resource centers. And apparently, there's a number of them around the country to support vets. Obviously, vets need a lot of help, depending on their circumstances. So we'll get into all of that with Jeff Stoffer as our first guest. Another regular, Rich Fiesta, will be joining us. Rich is the executive director of the Alliance for Retired Americans. He's got a lot to cover today. Number one, long-term care facilities are suffering from the worst labor crisis and job loss than any other healthcare sector. Nursing homes alone have seen their industry's employment level drop by 14%. That amounts to 221,000 jobs since the beginning of the pandemic. And a lot of these people are just not coming back. And keep in mind, we're not talking about very good pay in many of those nursing homes. So what's going to happen? Well, we'll find out from Rich. Rich is also going to get into the Build Back Better. That's the budget reconciliation package, which is appropriating a lot of money, almost $500 million, to provide appropriations for grants to states to support workers providing aid, nursing, and social work services. And lastly, if you go back a year when Trump was in office, he launched a new policy experiment designed to privatize traditional Medicare. Well, that raised a lot of eyebrows. Now, under this model, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services could move more than 30 million traditional Medicare beneficiaries into mostly commercial for-profit plans. They're called direct contracting entities, DCE, without the enrollees understanding or consent. This is pretty scary. And apparently, the Biden administration suspended this in March of this year. However, there's a couple of agencies that are still reviewing it because of the finances in Medicare. So we'll delve into that with Rich Fiesta as our second guest on the show today. Well, today is Friday and the last day of National Apprenticeship Week. The focus today is expanding registered apprenticeship programs to underserved populations. Once again, a clear pathway to the middle class, especially in those areas, urban areas, where a lot of young people do not see a way out. Now, speaking of apprenticeship programs, this announcement came down yesterday. Marty Walsh, the Labor Secretary, along with Switzerland's President Guy Parmelin, signed a memo of understanding to expand apprenticeships among Swiss companies and Swiss-invested companies in the U.S. and promote job creation in both countries. Swiss companies actively invest in U.S. manufacturing and directly support more than 500,000 U.S. jobs with an annual salary of $101,800. You probably didn't know that. Well, I certainly didn't when I saw the press release here. The signing took place at the Department of Labor's Francis Perkins Building as the nation marked the 7th annual National Apprenticeship Week this week. The celebration allows labor and business leaders, educational institutions, career seekers, and other partners to demonstrate support for apprenticeships in preparing a highly skilled, diverse workforce to meet the talent needs of employers. Marty said this, registered apprenticeships are a proven learn-while-you-earn model and path to good-paying middle-class jobs. And he knows that. He comes from the building trades. We have a little clip here I want to play for you from the Painters and Allied Trades marking this week, National Apprenticeship Week. Let's listen here on America's Workforce.
So you're thinking about your future. Many people today explore one path that includes spiraling student debt, unpaid internships, uncertainty about a job that would pay well, and lackluster benefits, if any. But there is another path, the path of a union apprenticeship. The Building Trades Union Apprenticeship Program has more apprentices than the 10 largest universities in our country have, students combined. Union apprenticeships like ours are earn while you learn. You get paid while you're learning the trade. Union apprenticeships like ours provide world-class education, free of charge. That's right, no student debt. Union apprenticeship programs are self-funded by current union tradesmen and tradeswomen. For future union tradesmen and tradeswomen, when you begin your apprenticeship, you begin your pension, start earning family-sustaining wages and high-quality benefits, all on day one. And when you finish your apprenticeship, you have learned a skilled trade that can keep you employed for the rest of your life. The starting salary for a building trades apprentice is above the median salary nationally, and you'll continue to make more as you master your trade. The job placement rate is above 95%, and your trade offers you flexibility to work throughout the country. This path has been taken by countless millions of Americans who benefited tremendously from the decision, not just themselves, but for their families too. Consider taking the path of the Building Trades Union Apprenticeship with us.
Once again, that's courtesy of the Painters and Allied Trades. Congratulations to Jimmy Williams Jr., president of IUPAT, for putting that together. Got a comment here from Sean McGarvey, who is president of the North American Building Trades Unions. He said, our robust labor management commitment and private multi-billion dollar investment in craft training ensure workers of all backgrounds, including veterans, women, and minority communities, can meet the demands of our competitive industry. Sean goes on to say, every year, tens of thousands of the most highly skilled construction workers complete our state-of-the-art registered apprenticeship programs, not only meeting the demands of the industry, but also fully equipped with portable skills for rewarding middle-class careers. Amen to that. Got some more details on the agreement at John Deere. After three tries, they have a new contract, and the workers are back on their jobs. We're talking about 10,000 of them. Comment here from Ray Curry, who is head of the UAW. United Auto Workers achieved victory this week after ending a month-long strike at John Deere. In a statement, John Deere members did not just unite themselves, they seemed to unite the nation in a struggle for fairness in the workplace. We could not be more proud of these members and their families. The new contract provides at least 10% raises, an $8,500 signing bonus, raises of 5% in 2023 and 2025, and tweaks how Deere calculates bonuses for workers who meet production targets. We talked about this on the show yesterday with one of the writers of The Nation magazine. That was a problem because they had this formula for meeting production targets, which was very hard to achieve. They'd have to be working really, really long days in order to do it. So apparently the two sides came together on that one. Enhanced fines for labor law violations remain in the House Democrats' plans for their tax and spending bill. The fines are estimated to generate $2.76 billion in revenue during a 10-year period. Now, the way the bill would work is by levying new, more severe penalties on conduct already prohibited by the Fair Labor Standards Act, including child labor and illegal overtime practices. The bill would also add penalties to enterprises who break the laws enforced by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. We'll see if that one stands up. They've been talking about this wrapping up perhaps this weekend. We'll find out. Stay tuned, as I say. All right, we have to take a quick break. Jeff Stouffer on behalf of the American Legion magazine coming up next.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy,
and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle at AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find more at oh.aft.org. If you missed our conversation with Melissa Cropper, president of the OFT, just go to awfradio.com, awfradio.com, post it all there. All right, let's go to line number one. Welcome one of our regulars, Mr. Jeffrey Stouffer, who handles media and communications for the American Legion. Legion.org is our website. He's here to talk about the December issue. And I'll tell you, there's one topic that I'm interested. I know a lot of our listeners are interested. It's a problem when it comes to union contracts, trying to get the best health care, get the best benefits. We're talking about health care. And in this case, we're talking about our public health system. And it's an interesting history. Jeff delved into it, and he even experienced it in a certain part of America in the Pacific Northwest. Jeff Stouffer, welcome back to America's Workforce. How are we doing today, brother?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me back.
All right. You've been traveling a lot, I know. And you were telling me Jeff is from Idaho, and he's been really, really busy going to Legion events all around the country. And healthcare is such an important issue. Unfortunately, what we have in America is a patchwork. And I think COVID-19 pretty much highlighted that. So, Jeff, I'm going to let you pick it up from there. Talk to me about this this article in the December issue.
Well, it sure did come to light during the COVID-19 pandemic that we are, it's interesting, the author of this piece, our cover story for the December issue by Alan Greenblatt, goes into the point that, that our public health, how we govern public health is very, very scattered. And I think everybody has endured at least some aspect of this. You know, I was even thinking from the World Health Organization to the CDC, to the states, to the White House, to, even frankly, the NFL has its own set of, guidelines and rules about how we manage and govern public health. And the author goes into, Alan Greenblatt goes into this and talks about how in a lot of the European countries, they have a governing authority over health and how they manage it and how they, deal with such things as a pandemic with, with mask requirements or immunizations and that sort of thing. But we have a big variety. And while we have, what we asked the author to do was sort of to try to give us a chart or a line of all of the players in this concern, especially, now through the pandemic. And, you've got, of course, the CDC, which frankly is most prominently a research arm, the Centers for Disease Control. And I think that he brings up the point that, remember, it's centers, multiple center, and they have each one of those within the Centers of Disease Control. You've got multiple different interests from, obesity to opioids to pandemic. And a lot of people were looking, well, is the CDC in charge of our public health system? And I think the question was, we have a big portfolio of different groups who are in charge of it. And we mentioned earlier that I kind of have confronted this a little bit in the last 18 months as I've gone back to visit family during COVID a little bit. And my family lives, part of my family lives on the Washington side of the Snake River, and part of my family lives on the Idaho side of the Snake River. And on the Washington side, the mask mandate and social distancing and restaurant access and all of that sort of thing, very restricted. In Idaho, wide open. So the difference was you at that time and for much of this time, you could just cross the river and you wouldn't have the same set of rules,
right,
for how you comported yourself during COVID. And this brought to my attention, how is it even cities, counties, tribes all have different, sort of rules and organizational structures about how they manage their health care, public health. And, this is an interesting phenomenon because especially with the pandemic, and the author gets into this, that over the last decade or so, there's been sort of a big reduction in public health jobs. And they have basically ratcheted back public health. I think he noted that there have been 60,000 jobs have been shed at state and local health departments since about 2008, 2009. And of course, and you look at the different, there's a county health department, there's a city health department, and all of these local agencies depend on federal funding, and federal funding depends on the higher priority of the federal government. For instance, if it's opioid addiction or something like that, they're going to say this amount of money has to go to this particular use, and they can't transfer those funds when we have an emergency come up like COVID-19. So you have an instant infusion of emergency funding. And in one of the points of that the author made was $57.2 billion, with a B, dollars in supplemental funding came to the CDC in response to the coronavirus pandemic, and about almost half of those local agencies depend on federal funding to conduct, you know, public health, you know, measures and to do all that. So it is so the patchwork, I would argue that, you know, the one thing we didn't really get into in this article, but it is in play with this, is the World Health Organization, which was is a UN specialized agency that was, you know, developed shortly after World War II, but it was to promote, you know, kind of universal international health among United Nations countries. And it is that's a piece of this. We remember all the controversy over the WHO during the early months of the pandemic. And then there's the CDC, which has its level of research and information and how they provide guidance. And then we had a White House coronavirus task force, which had, you know, not exactly the exact same set of thinking on that. And then you have, you know, the Food and Drug Administration, and you have, you know, there's a public health emergency preparedness program. There's a hospital preparedness program. So there are a lot of these different agencies that are built to handle a problem, a crisis like a COVID-19 pandemic, and yet they're not very well tethered together. And in the United States, I think that we all kind of saw this happen. I know that there are probably a lot of your listeners who are on border states where one state's governor might have one completely different set of restrictions or lack of restrictions due to COVID, and then another governor might have something completely different. And then the author, I think, kind of somewhat humorously, kind of sadly, makes the point that you've got all of these different voices competing with you know, what are we supposed to believe? And I think that's been a prevailing question since COVID broke out, is what are we supposed to believe? Is it all of these different competing agencies with different voices, or is it the theory that your cousin sends you on the latest misinformation he wrote via Facebook? So what do we believe? And I think we've seen I brought up the NFL, and I'm thinking about, you know, the Aaron Rodgers situation. He claimed to have been inoculated or immunized, or he had a different term for it, but it was a homeopathic immunization of some. So, I mean, is that okay? I mean, who says that's okay? What is okay? The NFL did not say that was okay, right? So, so we have different. Everybody has a different sort of set of beliefs and sort of theories and rules and things, and no two are quite alike. And that's the story that this author brings up. And he has a pretty good couple of sidebars with this package about that there were times when we were actually better at public health governing in history. And, you know, the smallpox, some of diphtheria and some of these other tuberculosis and some of these other infectious diseases that were cutting our lifespans by, like he makes a point, by three full decades. You know, in 1900, the average lifespan in America is 47.3 years. Now it's like almost 78. So we've done an okay job at various times in governing, you know, the possibility of having a bad, you know, disease or infections or a diphtheria or yellow fever or cholera or any of those things that don't seem to be with us much more. But now we are We are, I think what we saw, and he brings up, and this is kind of the point of his story, is how well prepared are we to face another public health crisis? Did we learn anything from this? Is there, you know, and I know that there's a lot of different opinions about how much the government should be in control or managing, you know, decisions about whether to immunize or when to immunize or what's going on there. But at the end of the day, all we have right now is like 25 different channels, all of which say something a little bit different. And right. that's the point of the story is, and he also brings up the point that in a kind of a history of vaccine resistance, it goes all the way back to 1796 when they developed the smallpox vaccine, and it reduced the death rate of smallpox in half. But they also had an anti-vaccine movement right after that, right around 1800, where people absolutely would not get vaccinated out of concern that the vaccine was worse than the disease. So this is nothing. What we've seen in the COVID-19 experience is not historically new, but again, we have, there's just all of these different schools of thought that are presented to us from different agencies who we hope to, you know, do what's right and do what's best for ourselves and our families. But who do we believe? And one of the points that the author makes is the public polls show that most Americans trust their local health department and their own personal doctor more than they do any bigger government agency. So it's still a patchwork.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That is kind of the question about, is that good? Is that bad? I can tell you one thing. I think if most people would agree, it's confusing.
Very confusing, to say the least. Great article. It's titled Our Patchwork Public Health System by Alan Greenblatt. And you can read it in detail in the December edition of the American Legion magazine. All right, Jeff, I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, hard to believe, 80 years since Pearl Harbor. We'll also talk about the National Veterans Resource Center. And later in the show, Mr. Rich Fiesta from the Alliance for Retired Americans will be joining us. Back in a few minutes.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
The United Steelworkers of America represent over 70,000 workers in the state of Ohio. Steelworker members enjoy the benefits of some of the best contracts of any workers in the world. Many of your friends, neighbors, and relatives are members of one of the most effective democratic unions in our country. With the pressures unorganized workers are under in today's economy, you need to join them. So call the Steelworkers Organizing Office at 216-292-5683 or toll free at 1-800-443-3752.
America's Workforce appreciates our sponsor, the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council, who represents more than 18,000 workers from 19 affiliated local unions and district councils.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, you can check us out on 6 platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and the platform known as Stitcher. When you get an opportunity, just take a minute, sign up, receive our shows on a regular basis. More and more people are doing that, so that is very much appreciated. Also, if you can, give us a rating. We always like those 5-star ratings. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the North Coast Area Labor Federation, which is connected to the AFL-CIO. Let's go back to our live line. Rejoin Jeff Stouffer on behalf of the American Legion. Been talking to Jeff since, I believe it was 2009. I can't believe how the years just flew by. I just love talking to Jeff and bringing up all the articles, great writers for the Legion magazine. And I'll tell you, hard to believe, but it's going to be 80 years since the attack on Pearl Harbor. And This is something to behold, because in the December issue, there is a story about a vice commander who talked about that fateful day. Jeff, I got chills when I read this story. I mean, it was like a firsthand account of what happened on December 7th, 19.
It was a piece that I encountered from when I was doing my research in the American Legion Centennial. And it was a personal written letter from a vice commander, a post vice commander in Hawaii from the American Legion, who basically said, this was our experience in the American Legion on the morning of December 7th, 1941, 80 years ago this year. And what he talked about was, like everybody, they all got up that morning. It was another, sunny morning in Hawaii, and began to hear the explosions and firing, and thought, this can't be training because this is too close. And it's Sunday morning. This is not some kind of maneuver. And sure enough, that was the Pearl Harbor attack was on. And, his quote was, this is war. And of course it was. And the vice commander gave this account. His name was A.A. Kempa. And he wrote this personal experience about what happened. And I thought it was interesting because, we generally talk about what happened, with the planes and ships and sailors and everything like that in World War II. But what happened was, the city was under siege too, and there were fires, lots of fires broke out across the city, and gave an account about how the American Legion post all got together that morning, and they began this massive relief effort to go around and to put out the fires and to get things removed from homes, from personal homes. There were a lot of people who were injured, wounded, and they had to perform, triage. And a lot of these guys, of course, at that time were primarily World War One veterans with a little bit of, military, combat experience, knew how to handle, crisis situations. But the winds were high, and they carried the flames to the stores and they into houses, and they would get a house empty, and then the roof would suddenly erupt into flames. And these legionnaires in Hawaii would work on this day and night for 10 days straight with all kinds of support duties, including, serving as orderlies to help the medics. And they managed traffic, and people were pretty panicked, of course. And all of the rumors that were going around, they investigated to find out if the Japanese were going to, were actually on the island and gonna invade, or what was going to happen. And then talked a little bit about how his son and some of the other kids basically became deputized as ambulance drivers because there were so many wounded. And I got to thinking, man, in today's day and age, could American Legion people and community people just jump into the crisis and become instant ambulance drivers? And probably not. But but that was when, back at a time when, community members in the face of a big problem would, jump to the issue and lean into it and get to work and whatever it took. And that's what the story is all about. It's they had all kinds of difficulties. And he talks a little bit about how Honolulu basically became an armed camp after the attack, of course, and everywhere. And there were curfews, and everybody in the hospitals and the schools and the restaurants and everything were all, shut down, and it just changed the whole routine for everybody, of course, after all of this happened in the weeks following the Pearl Harbor attack. So it was, it was a time of martial law. There was no alcohol. There was, but interestingly, he brings up the point that crime has fallen to an all-time low mark, and that food, gas, auto parts, radios, flashlights, firearms, and other materials were rationed and controlled. You know, just a tremendous amount of, it was a huge melee and very, very complicated time, of course. So anyway, I think a pretty rare firsthand account of an American Legion officer who assembled a team that went quickly to work to relieve the city at the time of its probably biggest disaster ever, the Pearl Harbor attack, which we recognize in December for its 80th anniversary. Hard to believe, isn't it?
Very much so. And to think about Honolulu, Hawaii, which essentially, for lack of a better term, is paradise, you know? Beautiful,
right.
Beautiful area. In an instant, it turns tragic, just like that. Lives changed. The world changed on that moment.
Right.
It's amazing. And this is all courtesy of the Vice Commander, A.A. Kempa, and it was part of a diary he submitted to the National Headquarters in January of 1942. And it appeared in the January 1942 National Legionnaire newspaper. So it's been resurrected for the 80th anniversary. Anything special going on for the 80th year on behalf of the Legion?
Yeah, well, of course, at Pearl Harbor, there will be, you know, the annual major ceremonies. And, you know, the thing about it is just like we see with the D-Day anniversary, every year there gets to be fewer and fewer until there are none who actually were there.
Right.
Firsthand. And so it's a time when we pretty much permanently say we'll never forget. We don't forget these massive events, the 9/11s, the Pearl Harbor attack, the Normandy invasion, you know, the things that have come to shape not only, you know, the military and veteran experience, but I think the national experience and you know, who we are as a country.
Absolutely. So, okay, Jeff, we got a couple of minutes left. There's one more that you wanted to get into, and that is the rise of the National Veterans Resource Center. And we talk about vets. You can't do enough for them. And obviously, this is just another example of what has been created to help vets. So I'm going to let you pick it up from here. What's going on with this Resource Center?
Well, this is an interesting story in that we've been associated with Syracuse University for many, many years, but recently, since like 2006, 2007, they had a program. This is when the big reality was that so many were coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan with traumatic injuries. And Mike Haney, who joined the faculty at Syracuse University, just basically to be a management professor. He'd taught at the Air Force Academy, and he was a better Air Force veteran and Air Force officer, developed a program to help those with, you know, traumatic wounds and injuries learn to become business people, to operate business, to teach them business so that they could become what we call, you know, service-disabled veteran-owned business owners. So, and it was a good program, and it was successful. And many of the student veterans who did it went through it and were successful in their business. So he thought, well, we could do something else. And so then they developed a women veterans entrepreneurial program. So he was teaching business to women veterans, and then another program rolled out, and then another program rolled out. And so out of that emerged in 2011. The Institute for Veterans and Military Families. And that thing really skyrocketed after the post 9/11 GI Bill was passed, because they just really took the lead and developed a massive research incubator. And they just had a handful of employees when they started this institute in 2011. Now they've got over 100 employees who are really the leading, provider of data and information about the post 9/11 veteran military experience. They have expanded their program in the last 12 years or so, to now they've served over 160,000 veterans and families. They're all across the country with different kinds of initiatives. And they have programs on 8 military bases for transitioning military to get kind of adjusted to life after service. And so it really has this building that they have, I was there and we brought the GI Bill exhibit, our national GI Bill exhibit up there to display. They asked for it because one of the things that's interesting about Syracuse was prior to World War II and the GI Bill, Syracuse was this like little regional college with an enrollment of about 4,000. And then in 1946, it went from 4,000 to 18,000 because of the GI Bill. So the GI Bill was a big factor in what Syracuse University became. And Syracuse was a private institution, and a lot of private institutions were not all that supportive of the GI Bill because they didn't think that, you know, your average veteran would survive well at a Ivy League school or not. So, but Syracuse was very, very supportive of the GI Bill, has always been. And the institution, this institute has evolved now into the National Veterans Resource Center, which I think, you know, to say what it is it treats everything from the individual veteran who's having trouble with adjustment or needs support in transition on campus who's a student veteran. You know, they have an art therapy studio inside the center. They have a hall of honor. They have many specialized classrooms. And what's interesting about this building, it's a $62.5 million building, and there are no stairs. It's all ramps. And it's elevators so that if you're using a wheelchair, you can get around and it's all, you know, Dr. Haney, Mike Haney, who is the vice chancellor kind of in charge of it, he said that, you know, it is probably the most accessible building in the state of New York. So it's a pretty phenomenal model for disability access, and it is an amazing resource. And one of the key points that he brings up is it's not just for the veterans, even though they've got multiple floors and they've got their ROTC training parade ground as part of it. And they do everything military and everything veterans does go on in there, but it's also open with classrooms and a big auditorium for all students. You know, they have, you know, it's registered as one of the classroom buildings. And so other students who don't know much about the military experience, that less than 1%, you know, who serve, and then the other, you know, 99.9% who don't, can come in and see just exactly what the military experience is about, what with this Hall of Honor, and they've got the story of famous Syracuse University alums who have served and done great things in the military. And at the same, so they it's both a support and it's an expression of this military heritage that Syracuse has. And I'm telling you, there is the Syracuse University and the George W. Bush Institute are kind of my go-to resources for collecting data for stories on the post 9/11 veteran experience, because they just have phenomenal research that comes out of that. Out of that incubator. And like I said, they've gone from this one little program that Dr. Haney created for traumatically wounded veterans into an international phenomenon. I mean, on 8 military bases and all across the country. So that's the rise. It started with one good idea, and then another good idea, and then another good idea, and then an institute. And now it is an internationally known institute on veterans resources.
That's good to hear. Obviously, the need is out there. Good stuff there. The rise of the National Veterans Resource Center. You can find more at legion.org. All right, Mr. Stouffer, you take care. We have to button it up here. I got Rich Fiesta of the Alliance for Retired Americans on line number 2. You stay safe. Best of the holidays coming up here, and we'll talk to you in December, okay?
Sounds great. Thanks for having me again. Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. As I indicated, coming up next, the Alliance for Retired Americans.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as health care and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit SurveyandBallotSystems.com to learn more.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And of course, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to line number two. Welcome one of our regulars, that being Mr. Rich Fiesta of the Alliance for Retired Americans. RetiredAmericans.org is their website. They're also on Facebook. Active Retirees is their Twitter handle. Hey, Rich, how are we doing today, brother?
Fine, Flash, and as always, great being with you.
Well, the big topic in Washington is this Build Back Better, the reconciliation deal. And I know you're watching it very, very closely because from what I'm reading, there's going to be a nice chunk of money for states involving worker recruitment, retention. Maybe you can give us some details on this because this goes into long-term care, things of that nature. Go ahead, Rich.
Yes. As you know, Flash, we've talked about this before. Every day, 10,000 Americans turn 65, so our population is aging. Older Americans need health care and use the health care system more than any other age group, obviously, and especially in the skilled nursing home and long-term care facilities. There has been a great need to have a workforce that is trained, that is stable, that is competent, and that is well paid to keep that stability. And the Build Back Better bill does a number of things exactly to strengthen and keep a stable workforce so we have better patient care for people who are obviously in great health needs in those facilities. One way is that, as you mentioned, there's over $400 billion for states to invest in worker recruitment and training. There's grants for better training and also money that will get better livable wages as well.
Okay, Rich, let me ask you this, because I've been following this legislation and it's always being whittled down. It's shaved down. I know there's a couple of politicians say, oh, we can't spend that much money. It's going to lead to more inflationary pressures. The money that we're talking about today, is that what we're talking about, or are they trying to chop some of that down, to your knowledge?
Well, that's what it is. As I mentioned, it's about $415 million for states to do programs, $150 to expand home care and services for seniors, people with disabilities as well. The original proposal by the president was higher, but, you know, this is where we are in a democracy and three branches of government, and two of them are concerned with spending. And this is still a very major step forward in stability in the long-term care world.
Okay. We'll take what we can get. And, you know, we should point out, too, about long-term care facilities. From what I've been reading, they are in the midst of the worst labor crisis ever. And let's get into this. Nursing homes alone have seen their employment level drop by 14%. We're talking 221,000 jobs here that are gone. Many of them, too, they're saying, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore. I got to find another line of work. As far as your experience on legislation, this legislation in Build Back Better would help that, especially when it comes to long-term care?
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, not surprisingly, with the pandemic and the lockdowns, and especially people in nursing homes and facilities like that, were the most vulnerable. So there frankly was a lot of, has been a lot of worker burnout, understandably. So the Build Back Better bill is to make things better in that world, to make people have a better workplace through better training, better wages, so that people who need care can get it by a stable, sustained workforce.
We cannot emphasize this enough, because I'm looking at some of the numbers here, and as Rich pointed out, we're not getting any younger. People are going to need nursing homes, long-term facility care. 58% of nursing homes are limiting new admissions because of what we're talking about on the show. That's something that needs to be addressed, and hopefully they can move the needle in the right direction. All right, let's get into this Medicare thing. I've been getting a couple of stories on this, and I'm glad we're talking about this, because under the Trump administration, there was a proposal to privatize traditional Medicare. I mean, you've been hearing that for years. Oh, we got to privatize. We got to privatize Social Security. They're going to go bankrupt, blah, blah, blah. So what's at stake right now? Because from what I read, Biden said no, but it's still on the table. Rich, help me out on this.
Yeah, this was another stealth move to privatize Medicare by the Trump administration, of taking traditional Medicare fee-for-service and so-called experiments, where if your provider, doctor, whatever, Medicare would allow private companies to come in, and if your provider signed up, then they would be administering and running the program instead of the way it's been done since 1965. And you, the patient, wouldn't have any say over it if your provider opted in. Well, the Biden administration put the brakes on that. In fact, more than put the brakes. It stopped that, because you could be assigned into one of these new provider private care models, and you wouldn't have any say on it. So the Biden administration stopped that. They are experimenting with another somewhat similar system to that, that would be voluntary. But we're, regardless of all of this, are watching this very closely, because what we've seen in the Medicare Advantage plan is, because of wrong coding by these private providers under Medicare Advantage, they've been getting over reimbursed, estimated by the accountants in the government, $7 billion in 2019 alone. That's about $300 per beneficiary of money that should not have gone from Medicare to the private Medicare Advantage plan. So for traditional Medicare, we have to be very careful about this too, and we're watching it like a hawk.
And I'll tell you, people right now are being bombarded, because we're in that open enrollment period, which goes on for a couple more weeks. Let me ask you this, Rich. What's the best advice? Should they go to the Alliance for Retired Americans to get some help on whether or not they should go into a certain plan? Do you have any guidance on that?
Yeah, there are some things on our website, retiredamericans.org. You can go through what each state, through the Medicare program, has what's called the SHIP, S-H-I-P program, that will help you. It's neutral. You can normally, through your local area agency on aging, that have people who are versed in what plans are available in your area, your community, your county, for example, without the TV hype you see of companies trying to sell their own plans.
Oh, yeah, I know. All the celebrity endorsements. I hear you, buddy. All right. RetiredAmericans.org. That's a good start there. Rich, you take care. Stay safe. Best of the Thanksgiving holiday. We'll talk to you next month. Okay, brother?
Great being with you, Flash. Talk to you then.
All right. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up on Monday, the Illinois AFL-CIO and the Transportation Trades Department of the AFL-CIO. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful weekend.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.